Thank you for listening today. We have important information for you. This is the Health and Happiness Show on KGVM 95.9 FM or KGVM.org. This is Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with co-host Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. The Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association supports us and has so for approximately 8 years. We are broadcast at 7 p.m. on Monday evenings and Thursday mornings at 9. Now, Dr. Suzanne will introduce the program, the guest, and the topic.
From birth to our golden years, our skin is a long-serving ally. From the Health Foundation of Suze Howe Science and Technology Bureau, we hear skin is more than a physical barrier. It plays a crucial role in overall health, emotional well-being, and social interactions. Beyond its primary function in protection and sensation, the skin actively influences extracutaneous systems through immune regulation, endocrine signaling, and microbiome interactions, so that dermatological conditions such as psoriasis, eczema, and rosacea are linked to systemic inflammation, cardiovascular risks, and metabolic disorders, demonstrating the skin's far-reaching impact on overall health. Additionally, skin appearance affects psychological health, self-esteem, and social engagement, reinforcing its significance beyond physiology. Maintaining skin integrity in aging populations may help mitigate the progression of systemic diseases associated with inflammation and aging. On the other hand, enhancing epidermal function in neonates or newborns, particularly preterm neonates, lowers the risk of infections and mortality rates while promoting weight gain. Understanding these broader influences of skin can lead to more holistic therapeutic strategies, emphasizing dermatological health as a component in overall well-being. And that brings us to why we are so honored today to have Dr. Molly Buckland, dermatologist par excellence, here with us today. Thank you, Dr. Molly, for being here to talk with us about the importance of our skin care, and every impact it has on our lives.
Thank you for the excellent introduction, Suzanne, and I'm so happy to be here today.
Well, we just feel like skin is something that all of us have all kinds of ideas about. From the Skin Health Foundation, we could start out maybe talking about some of the myths or mysteries about skin. The Skin Health Foundation points out several of these, and you could speak to these, because one myth is that you don't need sunscreen on cloudy days. Is that true, Dr. Molly?
So you absolutely need sunscreen even on cloudy days.
Yes.
And the reason for this is because the UV radiation does penetrate the clouds. So you are still getting the damage from the sun's rays, but you don't realize it quite as much. So it's just as important as those sunny days, if not more important, because you are tempted to be outside longer and without protection, and therefore you are getting a lot more damage. I always remind people, especially in Montana, that it's very important, even in the winter, to apply sunscreen and to protect themselves from the sun with hats and clothing, especially on those snowy, sunny days, because the reflection from the snow is also an important factor in sun damage.
What kind of sunscreen do we need?
So my recommendation is SPF 30 or higher, and you want to look for something that says broad spectrum, and that means that you are protecting yourself from both UVB and UVA, which is important to remember. The UVA is the aging rays, and the UVB are the burning rays. Mineral sunscreen is probably the best protectant that you can get. But the chemical sunscreens do a pretty darn good job as well. And so I believe that's really personal preference. But you want to make sure that it's SPF 30 or higher and broad spectrum. And other than that, any brand will do.
Excellent. And just to point out here, that same group lets us know that ultraviolet rays can penetrate clouds. Up to 80% of that radiation will reach your skin even on overcast days. So there's just a real strong component to that myth. Okay, thank you, Dr. Molly. Next myth, oily skin doesn't need moisturizer. Is that true?
Well, I would say that most skin does need moisturizer, and the reason is because you're protecting the skin barrier. So oily or dry, your skin barrier still needs protection. And so I do find that moisturizer does help kind of seal those cracks that can happen in the skin that can lead to irritation and rashes and itching. I would say that oily skin people may not need it quite as frequently or as often, but they might just need a different version of a moisturizer, something that's a little lighter, not so occlusive as somebody with more dry skin. So I would say that, you know, that's probably a myth and a half.
Yeah. So the key is to use a lightweight moisturizer that hydrates without clogging pores. Always a good idea, I would guess.
I had a quick question. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a myth, at least among people I've known, that if you had one bad sun exposure, let's say you were young and had a really, really bad sunburn, that really wouldn't make any difference.
So actually, even one very bad sunburn, let's say like a blistering or peeling sunburn, can cause skin cancer many, many years down the line. So really all it takes is one, especially in a very fair-skinned person, and you do increase your risk of skin cancer exponentially.
I hear you, yeah.
Next myth, anti-aging products are only for older people.
So I would say this is absolutely a myth. Protecting your skin and keeping it healthy, even in your younger years, when it still looks young, is very important in your older years. And I always tell people this, especially with sun protection, that they'll thank me later when they're in their 40s and 50s and their skin looks younger because of what they did in their 20s and 30s. So it is very important to actually start early and think about the longevity and the future of your skin, because it's going to be with you into your old age. And the things that you do in your younger years absolutely will help you look younger and your skin be healthier and prevent skin cancer down the line as well.
I had one kind of silly question. Does hair alone protect the top of your head?
Not necessarily, and it really does depend on the thickness of your hair. You know, somebody with very, very thick hair obviously is going to have more protection, like a thick, dark head of hair. But parts and hairlines are still going to be very vulnerable, and it's a part of the skin people forget about a lot. So as a skin cancer surgeon, I actually do a lot of surgeries on the scalp. I would say, you know, by far, and the majority of them are on older men who don't have a lot of hair. But even I will do skin cancer surgeries on women, especially on the part. So the midline part is a big area that people forget to protect. So you do have to remember that. And there's actually a couple of good products out there. They make powders for scalps, so you can brush it right into the hair without it feeling, you know, greasy or goopy. Sprays work pretty well for that as, you know, for protection. So there's nice products to use, but it's a definitely an area not to forget. And my recommendation is to protect the scalp with a hat always. A wide-brimmed hat is always going to be better than a baseball cap.
So I'm really in trouble then.
Yes, exactly.
I'll get him a hat. Okay, so next myth, expensive skincare products are always better.
So that is not true at all. I tell people all the time that a inexpensive moisturizer, sunscreen, cleanser, they generally all have the same ingredients or very similar ingredients. So your over-the-counter CeraVe or Cetaphil product oftentimes is just as good as an expensive cleanser or moisturizer that you might buy. I will say there are a couple products that are worth spending a little extra on. Those would be medical grade skincare for things like wrinkles or dark spots, vitamin C serums or antioxidants. Generally speaking, the higher grade products are a little bit more expensive and they are going to be more effective. But when it comes down to moisturizers, sunscreens, and cleansers, I would say whatever you like, and you don't have to break the bank on those.
Thank you. Okay, myth number 9. You should switch skincare products frequently to keep your skin from getting used to them.
No, I don't necessarily think that is necessary. I think your skin doesn't generally get used to things in the way that that is implying. There are certain things, like if you're thinking about anti-aging products, where you might need to go up in a strength or basically a concentration, because your skin will get used to that, and then you could potentially handle a higher strength or percentage of something and get more benefit from it. But I don't think you necessarily have to switch your products every few months. If your skin feels good and it looks good and you like the way your products feel, then you can keep using them.
Exactly. Thank you. Okay, one more. You can rely on makeup with SPF for sun protection. Your makeup can do the job. Is that true?
Generally speaking, no, it's usually not enough. Makeup tends to not have a high concentration of sunscreen. It's usually SPF 15, sometimes even lower. And most people aren't applying enough makeup to get the protection that they need. That being said, there are a couple brands that make sunscreen that acts like a makeup, and those do a really, really good job. One of them that I like in particular is called Color Science. It's a brand that goes on like a makeup, but it acts like a sunscreen. So in general, I would say that your over-the-counter makeup products are not going to have enough protection.
Exactly again. Well, so we got a bunch of myths out of the way and some real good no-nonsense suggestions. Is there anything else that you come across in your experience, Dr. Molly, that people typically might get wrong or misunderstand?
Yeah, I would say there's a couple things, especially related to sunscreen. One of the things I hear a lot from people is asking, well, doesn't sunscreen cause cancer? I shouldn't use it because it's dangerous to my health. And my answer for that generally is that there's actually no studied or reported events of sunscreen causing any harm or cancer. But that being said, if you are worried about that potential threat, especially with the chemical sunscreens, because they do get absorbed into your bloodstream, so they have found very minor concentrations in people's bloodstreams in these studies that they've done, but there has been no implication to that. But we don't know what might happen along the line, you know, 20 or 30 years from now. We don't know what the implication might be. If you're really looking for the safest option, it's to get a mineral-based sunscreen. And so that would be the ones with metals in them, like zinc or titanium. And the reason for this is because those metals aren't being absorbed into your bloodstream. They're just sitting on the surface of the skin and causing the sun's rays to reflect. So you just basically wash these off and they're not absorbed into your body. The other nice thing about mineral sunscreens is that they're slightly better for the environment. So, you know, there's no damage to things like coral reefs or water supplies. So that's why often when you go to places like Hawaii or Mexico or any beach vacation destinations, they do actually recommend that you wear certain types of sunscreen in the water so that you're not damaging any of the marine life. So that would be one of the biggest myths that I come across. Or people ask me about. And then I think the biggest one we already really touched on is the, you know, a lot of people say they wear sunscreen when they go outside or they're out on the lake or hiking or something like that, but they don't wear it regularly. And I really try to get across to people that regular use of sunscreen is much better. So every single day I tell people to make it part of their morning routine and just to make sure they at least get it on their face, their ears, their neck, chest, and the tops of their hands. Because if you think about driving around in your car, the glass on your car, all of those UV rays penetrate glass. So even if you're sitting in front of a window in your office, you're still getting UV radiation through the glass.
Fair warning. Yes, we should all take this to heart. Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Molly.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there's another branch of dermatology, and it's called psychodermatology, and from the American Psychiatric Association, they point out that more than one-third of dermatological patients have psychological concerns. Psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, and eczema are among the diseases most associated with co-occurring mental health conditions. So that people with chronic skin conditions, like those we mentioned, have difficulties often with low self-esteem, number one, concerns with body image, number two, and social isolation, number three. This can truly impact a person's social interactions, employment, quality of life, and overall mental well-being. So our skin is out front with us all the time, it seems, Dr. Molly, and there are real impacts when we have skin difficulties, and I'm sure you talk with many people experiencing these difficulties.
Yes, I see this every single day in my job, and you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, if you have a disease of the skin, it's often very hard to cover it up. It's what people see when they see you, is they see your skin. And so if it looks different, that absolutely affects your quality of life. So I do find this a lot with psoriasis and atopic dermatitis, especially in severe cases. People can have these diseased areas of their skin pretty much everywhere on their body. So again, it can affect quality of life because maybe they're itchy, or maybe they don't want to go out and show their skin in a social situation. And so this is really tough for people. And I think the good news about practicing dermatology in today's world is that we actually have a lot of really amazing medications for these diseases. And you can actually get your skin almost completely clear. And I've seen this be incredibly life-changing for people. So these medications can be safe and effective, and that's really what you're looking for. And so I think that that's why it's such an amazing time to be a dermatologist, is because we actually can potentially, you know, in a way, cure these diseases. They're always going to be chronic, but with the medications that we have available to us, you can make people better, which is really amazing. I think the other kind of the psychological component I see a lot is people with acne. I think that's a really tough disease, especially because most people who are getting acne are in their teenage years, where things are already tough, you know, in a social, psychological way, and with hormonal changes, acne oftentimes is one of those things that a lot of teenagers will struggle with. And so that's another important role as a dermatologist, is to help those kiddos feel better about themselves and increase their self-confidence.
Yeah, one of the sadder things I read about in looking into this was that many people who have a visible skin condition at some point will notice a person making an effort not to touch them at all because of their skin. And this can have a profound impact and make that individual feel ashamed and also more likely to notice or look for similar events. So, you know, that just seems like it would be so demoralizing. And I know that very few of these rosacea and other things would be something somebody could catch by touching. Is that correct, Dr. Buckland?
That's correct. It is. There are very few skin diseases that you can catch by touching, especially these common ones like psoriasis or eczema. And so, yeah, that can be really hard for people when the kind of social implication is that they are contagious or diseased. And I think that even goes way, way, way back into history, you know, with leper colonies, where leprosy actually is a contagious disease. But I think that that's kind of followed through in history to be a real issue with people that have non-contagious skin diseases. And so I actually make it a point with a lot of my patients to actually touch them. And, you know, especially if they have these diseases that you're never going to catch by touching them, to touch them and not wear gloves in the exam, to make sure that they know that this is not part of their problem. It's not that they have to isolate themselves and they don't have to let people not touch them, and they can hug their family and they're not going to give it to other people.
I found in my practice over the years a few times I've had referrals for trichotillomania, or even I believe it's called dermatillomania. There may be another name for that one. How do you approach those?
These are really tough diseases. You know, they're so linked to psychological issues like stress and anxiety and depression. So oftentimes co-management of these is very important with somebody that, you know, can do counseling or behavioral therapy, sometimes even medication, as far as like, you know, treating anxiety and treating depression. Those things can significantly help with these types of diseases. So I think it's important as a dermatologist to make sure there's not an underlying kind of organic or skin condition going on, because you can have people that get hair loss, let's say for other reasons, you know, for inflammatory reasons or a fungal condition, et cetera. So I think that's really where the role of the dermatologist is ruling out other causes. And then, you know, your psychiatrist or psychologist would be really important with the underlying kind of mental issues that could be going on.
I forgot to describe what they are. Would you describe what those two conditions are?
As far as trichotillomania or dermatillomania?
Yes,
Sure. Trichotillomania is a condition where people pull out their hair. And so generally it's called hair pulling disease is another way to say it. So they'll usually end up with bald patches in their scalp, and it becomes this kind of cycle that is really, really tough to break, because anytime, and I find it's a lot of times related to anxiety. If somebody's feeling anxious, they start to kind of pick at their hair, or pull at their hair, twirl it in their fingers, and a lot of times they'll start pulling it out as well. And then dermatillomania, or skin picking disorder, is where people will pick at their skin. And you see this a lot actually with people who have acne as well. They'll pick at their acne and cause scarring and crusting. So that's really a, you know, it can be a huge problem and lead to infection and scarring down the line. So that's a really important one to get under control if you can very early. But these are really tough conditions.
And, you know, I think we need to think about that there are positive outcomes. I know that I've read across the research field here that CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, in coordination with the dermatology, can work through these very difficult, highly resistant kinds of disabilities.
Yeah, so I agree. You have to have a kind of multimodal approach to these disorders, and cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to work really, really well. So I think that's really important to make sure that people are in the right hands of, a therapist who is able to perform that.
I have watched a show on TV that Suzanne hates. It's called Dr. Pimple Popper. And
yes.
I actually really found it fascinating, the conditions that she deals with. I'm sure you've dealt with many of those as well.
Yes, she is pretty amazing. I really enjoy her show as well. And I think I always tell people there's people that enjoy that stuff and there's people that don't, and there's really nowhere in the middle. but I think that Dr. Sandra Lee is pretty impressive, and she's a really good dermatologist. So I actually think that the things that she deals with on her show are very important to put out into the public to know that, you know, these things happen and you don't have to wait until they're, you know, the size of a basketball to get them looked at. So, I think that she's actually putting a pretty important message out there.
And what I found that many of the conditions that you've described and that she deals with, people have many times had them for years, and it's caused all kinds of social and psychological problems, usually social withdrawal and social isolation.
Yes, exactly. I mean, a lot of these people will have big growths in areas that you can't really hide, like the face or the neck. I just love that she is getting people taken care of and getting them back to a more normal life. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. You know, we've talked a lot about adults, but this, as we said earlier, actually can begin very early in life. One example of the complexity would be atopic dermatitis, a skin condition resulting in rashes and itchy skin. And in early infancy, it can interfere with bonding between mother and child. Babies with atopic dermatitis may not be able to tolerate being held and may be irritable, which may be difficult for parents and other caregivers. Children with atopic dermatitis may experience social isolation, and parents may have feelings of helplessness. Older children and teens may experience bullying and difficulties with some social and sporting activities. So I guess I was going to ask Dr. Molly, if you have many young people that come to you or babies that need intervention and family support.
Yes, we do see kids quite often, and I think that atopic dermatitis, or eczema is another name for that, is probably one of the more common pediatric dermatology conditions that we treat. It's extraordinarily common. And really the problem with it is it varies to such a degree person to person how severe it is. So I would say in our office we don't see the severe cases quite as much, and if we do, sometimes they're very, very difficult to get under control as far as with treatment and getting them into more of a remission. But it's really, really hard on these kids. It's hard on the parents because you want to be able to fix it. And sometimes it's a disease that's actually not fixable without certain medications. And it can be really hard, especially I imagine for, you know, new parents with an infant with severe atopic dermatitis, because that infant is going to be more fussy and uncomfortable and itchy. And they can't tell you that. And so it's really, that is definitely a really hard thing to deal with. And I find it interesting about the, you know, bonding with parents, and I could see that absolutely being a problem.
Do insurance companies cooperate, like in treatment and paying for the medication, or is there a resistance to that?
There is definitely some hoops that you have to go through to get certain medications covered through insurance companies. Of course, a lot of these newer medications that work really well and tend to be safe and effective compared to older therapies that are more inexpensive, they usually want you to try some of the older, more inexpensive therapies first before they're going to approve a newer and more expensive treatment. And we actually have a whole job description within our office, one person who has to handle all of this stuff, because there's so much work involved on our end to get these medications covered. So we have to do a lot of prior authorizations and appeals if it gets denied. A lot of patients may not even be able to afford the copay, even if the medication is covered by their insurance. And so oftentimes we have to use the specific company's programs that are called patient assistance programs to get people on these medications. So yes, it's really, really tough. We do, you know, we have that particular position in our office so that we can hopefully get them on medications that they need. But it does take a significant amount of time and effort to do so.
That's kind of amazing to hear. It requires a whole additional member of your team just to deal with those issues. But bravo that you've done that good work and can help people with that.
Yes, thank you. I think it is really important, because when you see the medications work and you do see people get better, that makes it all worth it.
Absolutely. And we wondered if you could just maybe give the people out here listening, what is a good daily skin care process? What do people need to do morning, noon, and evening and night for skin, not just facial, but maybe all of our skin?
Sure. I guess we could start with like a very simple facial routine. I tend to think simple routines are much better than a 12-step, you know, very complicated routine, because your skin really doesn't need that much. And sometimes too many products can actually disrupt the natural skin barrier, which you don't want to do. So for a morning routine, I like a gentle cleanser followed by a vitamin C serum or an antioxidant. And what these do is they're going to help with UV radiation, pollution, any thing that's out in the environment that can cause, you know, damage to the skin. Those antioxidants are going to help throughout the day. And then followed by a SPF 30 broad spectrum sunscreen. And that's really it for your morning routine. In the evening, another gentle cleanser, basically to wash off all of the impurities and the things that have happened throughout the day, followed by a retinol or a retinoid. This is going to be important for anti-aging, so collagen production, wrinkle reduction over time, and then a nice moisturizer right over top of that. So that's kind of the simple morning and evening facial routine. As far as for the rest of your body, in dry climates like Montana, washing with soap or harsh antibacterial soaps or even any scented harsh soaps every single day, you actually don't want to do that. I usually tell people, especially people who suffer from dry skin, in the shower, all you really need to wash are the parts that get stinky. So you're thinking about, you know, underarms, the groin area, feet, behind the ears, places like that. Other than that, your arms and legs generally don't need soap every single day. Like a warm water rinse is really all you need to do to keep those parts clean, unless they're physically soiled with dirt or mud or anything like that. So that is definitely a good way, especially in the winter here in Montana, to keep your skin from drying out too much. And then I usually like people to put a moisturizer on their entire body right after they get out of the shower when their skin is a little bit damp, and that'll help seal in that moisture that will basically is kind of leached out of your skin from showering.
You'd have to out the belly button.
The belly button, that's an important one too.
Oh, I remember when Arliss and I got married that, you know, I met his mom, and she mentioned, oh, you know, my legs and arms are just wrinkled, and it's just, I'm just getting old now. And I said, Anna, you're not getting old, you're just dry hair. And we started moisturizing everything, which she had not done, and her skin just looked wonderful. So speaking about aging and the use of daily good sense, especially like you mentioned, the shower, you don't really need soap. I can attest to that regimen perfectly. But does using this regimen that you've recommended, full body lotion, that really does help prevent wrinkling, doesn't it?
Yes, in a way, it will definitely help that kind of wrinkly, dry, crepey skin that you see when skin does get very dried out or desiccated. It will help rehydrate the skin, and you want to look for a moisturizer that's a thick cream moisturizer, looking for words like ceramides. Things with hyaluronic acid can help with this as well, basically things that will help plump up the skin. Unfortunately, they're not going to turn back the clock at all. They're not going to fight the aging process. So you're still going to get that loss of collagen and, you know, the thinning of skin over time, which does lead to that kind of saggy or crepey appearance to the skin. So moisturizer isn't going to fix that, but it sure is going to help with kind of the plumpness, the hydration, and that barrier of the skin so that it's going to look a lot healthier.
Over long periods of time, humanity has developed cultures that sometimes are based on myths and our religious distortions or that kind of thing. And I was have a list of things here, and if you could comment on them. There's circumcision, female genital mutilation, tattooing, piercing. What's good, what's bad?
Well, I can't really comment in my practice as much about circumcision and genital mutilation, but I do think those things are fairly antiquated. The tattooing, we actually have seen probably, I mean, I see a lot of tattoos. I think it's very popular in, you know, the younger generations. So we don't really know exactly the implications within the skin. We do know that tattoo ink is often found in lymph nodes, especially if you have a lot of ink on your skin. It does, your immune system essentially will go and kind of gobble up some of that tattoo ink and store it in your lymph nodes. It's unclear if that's hazardous to your body or not, or whether your body just kind of stores it there and it doesn't do much at all. But we do see a lot of that in our office as far as a lot of people that do have tattoos. It's very culturally accepted. And there's also, on the flip side of that, a lot of people who get tattoos and come to a dermatologist's office for tattoo removal because they don't want it anymore. So there are certain laser procedures that can be done to remove tattoos after the fact. I will say it's not super simple as far as procedures go, so never get a tattoo thinking, oh, I'll just get it removed later. Because the process is multiple treatments, it's very painful and it's very costly.
And it's quite worrisome that it settles down in the lymph nodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we don't really know what that means, but it absolutely has been found there. And actually, very interesting, oftentimes when we do surgery on people who have tattoos, let's say we remove a spot within a tattoo, you can actually see all that ink under the microscope within the skin. And so that's just an interesting finding.
I know we used to work in nursing rehabilitation facilities, and there'd be some fellow then maybe 70s, 80s that had gotten a tattoo in the Navy many, many years ago, and it probably looked really good then, but when it begins to sag, it has some unusual shapes, and they don't like it, but at that stage, probably they're not going to do a whole lot about it.
No, yeah, you've got it. I think a lot of people just live with it at that point. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just wanted to ask, just in case we ever see the sun again, which in Bozeman we might not, possibly, with all the snow and all, but tell us how to think about the sun and our skin, please, Dr. Molly. We've talked a bit about it.
And how to get vitamin D otherwise, yeah.
Right, so thinking about like kind of the healthy balance, I think is what people need to know, because I love the outdoors. I'm a dermatologist and I still go outside. And I just tend to try to protect myself well when I do it. So, you know, there definitely is some important health factors for being outside and getting sunshine. It makes you feel good. You know, that's one of the major reasons people go out, because the sun makes you feel happy and alive and energized. And so I do think it's important not to live your life inside, hold up like a vampire. But protect yourself when you do it. So when you're recreating, make sure you are wearing sunscreen and a hat. And I always love sun protective clothing here in Montana, because it doesn't feel too heavy or sweaty to wear a lightweight shirt, or, you know, a hat outside. And we do make vitamin D through our skin. So that is important as far as, you know, your internal health. Even so, I find most people don't make a majority of their vitamin D through their skin, especially fair-skinned people. So most people still need to supplement with vitamin D, make sure they're getting it through their diet and taking supplementation to actually get enough to make a difference. So just getting vitamin D or expecting to get enough through sunlight is actually usually not sufficient. So I think making sure you're getting your vitamin D checked at least once a year with your primary care physician and supplementing as needed is very, very important.
I've noticed that there have been some push through marketing about having men shave hair on their bodies. Is that good or bad?
You know, I think that's really just personal preference. I think that's just cultural norms shifting over time. And, you know, I think the pendulum swings one way and then it'll swing the other depending on what marketing strategies are out there. So, you know, I don't think it's good or bad. I think it's really just personal preference. You know, if people are shaving large portions of their body, sometimes you'll get more rashes. So that's definitely something to consider. People will get things like folliculitis or inflammation of those hair follicles, particularly like you could spread, you know, warts or bacterial viruses by shaving large portions of the body. Maybe those are the hazards, but other than that, I think it's okay.
What about warts? I know that growing up, there was always some kid that had a wart and there were different ways allegedly to remove them. What is a good way?
Oh, there's really no great ways. I'll start off by saying that I always think warts are actually one of the more difficult things that we treat. And I think the reason for that is because they're not super harmful to us. You know, in a way that our immune system doesn't really care if we have warts. I always tell people the way we treat warts is to get your immune system to recognize that it needs to fight off that virus. Otherwise, it just is there, and it's going to be there for a long time, sometimes years, before maybe it will spontaneously go away. So warts are really tough to treat. It takes a lot of persistence for the patient to do some at-home treatments. In the office, we can do things like freezing them. Sometimes we inject them with different sorts of medications, basically to elicit an immune response or a lot of inflammation. Sometimes we do end up cutting them out. I would say that's a kind of the last resort scenario. Otherwise, it's a lot of patience and persistence and just hoping that they'll go away quickly.
And one more thing, toe fungus. Like toenail fungus.
Toenail fungus, yeah. That's another tough one because, again, this is one of those things that's almost commensal with our body. That fungus lives there. Our body doesn't care that it's there. So your immune system doesn't really fight off the fungus. Once it's in the nail, it's really, really tough to treat it because a lot of medications don't penetrate the nail very well. So we have a couple options in that case. And I always tell people it really depends on how much it bothers you. because the options, none of them work very well. You're sometimes going to get a cure, but oftentimes it looks like it goes away. You stop treatment and that fungus will grow right back. So, you know, there's topical options. They don't work very well. There's oral medications. So oral antifungals can work, but generally speaking, you're going to be on a medication for a long period of time and sometimes get more like a 60% cure rate, maybe less than that, maybe more than that, depending on the person. And they can potentially have internal side effects, which a lot of people choose not to take them for that reason.
We men then, I guess, who have that and can't seem to get rid of it, probably ought to start painting our toenails, do you think?
I like that idea. Yeah, just paint them, cover it up. And I always find it interesting that toenail fungus is remarkably hard to spread to your partner. You'll have one person, you know, they live together, they sleep together, shower in the same shower. And one person in the family will have it and nobody else will. So I always find that very interesting.
Absolutely. I was wondering if we could go back for a bit to talk about how we really need to try to cope with and manage our stress in thinking about our skin. For example, I'm reading from Skin Health that there's a lot of extra inflammation that may begin in the gut and lead to nervous system inflammation in the skin, and that external stressors can permeate the skin, and chronic stress increases levels of inflammatory situations and trigger autoimmune and inflammatory skin conditions. They disrupt cortisol levels and overall hormonal balance, and that can contribute to other skin conditions, including acne, as well as premature aging. And so we find the skin also produces its own signals in response to stress and send those back to the brain, creating a feedback loop. In other words, our skin can talk to our brains and say, look at me, there's something going on we need to address. And so stress is a big factor in what happens with our skin. Do you often address that with folks, or is it something they should look at it from other sources, Dr. Molly?
Yes, I do address this with people, because you're absolutely right in that there is, like, just like the gut-brain connection, and this, there's a skin-brain connection, and stress and inflammation, it is a negative feedback cycle or positive feedback cycle, I guess, and it can disrupt all of the signals in the body, including the skin, and cause different things to happen, especially I find acne, like you said. Actually, eczema is triggered by stress. There's a lot of other rashes that can be exacerbated by it as well. So I do address this in people when it's necessary. But the thing is that in my line of work, it's not really my position to fix that stressor, right? But it is to let people, or to educate them on the stress in their life is absolutely contributing to what's going on their skin, so they can understand that connection. But, you know, it's so tough because people will say, well, of course I'm stressed, you know, life is stressful. So it's really hard because we do live in a stressful time, and it's hard to mitigate stress, but there is a connection there for sure.
Yeah, from New Zealand publication, health psychologist there, they said that simply thinking about itch is enough to trigger actual itch sensations, and that stress modifies the threshold for noticing itch. In other words, it will build in an itch if we start focusing on that.
Yes, itch is a very interesting and dynamic problem. because there's a lot of things that can cause itching, and there's a lot of kind of psychosomatic connections to itch. So yes, it's very much a can be connected to the nervous system and the brain, and those are the hardest things to treat.
I know in my field, going into convention, oftentimes there are people selling devices that measure galvanic skin response, or they say things like biodots that supposedly when you relax they change color, or the meter shows that your galvanic skin response changes to progressive muscle relaxation or something. Is that valid?
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer fully, but I imagine that there could be some legitimacy to that, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, we sometimes get biodots. I think they change from kind of purple to black to green, and supposedly if you relax, they'll I think the best color is purple. I'm not sure. But anyway, that's good feedback. Thank you.
We have some information from the Mayo Clinic along the lines of what you've been saying. They ask you to protect yourself from the sun, and they even describe wearing protective clothing that actually screens out, blocks out UV rays. They say, whatever you do, don't smoke, because that really plays a part in your skin aging. And like you said, they recommend treating your skin gently, like limiting your bath time, not using strong soaps and detergents, shaving carefully, and pat dry after you wash or bathe. Don't scrub. Use a moisturizer. They emphasize eating a healthy diet. And along the lines that we've been talking about, they say it's really necessary to manage stress. So that's an overall view. Which of those things do you highlight a lot, Dr. Molly?
Gosh, I think all of them are really important, actually. So I think that was a really nice overview. And just to kind of go into the diet part of a little bit, because I think a lot of people are interested in how dietary things can affect skin diseases. But for skin healing specifically, especially as a skin surgeon and dealing with wounds a lot, there are a lot of things in our diet, I think, that we probably are missing out on that could help our skin be more healthy and heal faster. And those are things like high protein diets, healthy fats, vitamin C, zinc, copper. All of those things are really important, actually, to how the skin develops and how it heals. Those are kind of the building blocks to the healing process. So it's really, important to have a healthy, balanced diet and to eat real food and have, high vitamin D, vitamin A. That's really important for our skin as well.
Thank you. We wonder, too, we're getting closer to the end here. We'd like you to tell us where you're located and how to reach you if people out there feel the need for a referral. But we have one friend who had a little spot on his arm, and he went to a doctor, just a medical GP. This was a while back in another state. And doc said, oh, that's okay. That's not going to bother you at all. And it ended up, it was a melanoma, and it took this mm-hmm. dear friend's life. When would you say that a sore or a lesion on a person's skin is something they need to bring immediately to you?
So we talk about the ABCDEs of melanoma a lot, and those are things like asymmetry, irregular border, different colors within a lesion, the diameter of the lesion. I think that one doesn't hold a lot of validity because melanomas and skin cancers can be less than a pencil eraser. But if anything is large or growing, those might be things to be worried about. evolution. The E is the most important, in my opinion. This is changing rapidly over time. So anything that's evolving or changing doesn't look like it did a couple months ago. Those are things that need to be evaluated sooner rather than later. So that's the most important one, in my opinion, because a lot of normal or benign or non-cancerous lesions can do all of the ABCDs. But evolution is very important because you're not going to know if something is good or bad by looking at it. And that's why you're going to rely on somebody who's had a lot of training looking at thousands and thousands of different skin lesions to know if this is something that's to be worried about. So I always tell people when they come into the office for, let's say, a lesion of concern, and then I tell them, oh, this is nothing. This is just an age spot. But, you know, better to know that it's nothing than to have not come in and have it be something more dangerous.
And there's also good reason here that one should seek a dermatologist with that kind of question. For example, from our friend, you need somebody, like you said, who knows exactly what's on your arm or leg or whatever.
Exactly. And I'll just kind of go into a little bit about, just for a minute or two, about what it takes to become a dermatologist and why it's so important to see a medical doctor for these particular skin conditions. Because a dermatologist goes through 4 years of medical school, and then they actually do 4 more years of training after medical school. And so that includes an internship, 3 years of dermatology, very rigorous didactic schedule. So it's a very book-heavy specialty. But in that time, during those 4 years of residency, we're seeing thousands of patients. We are looking at lesion over lesion and getting that education. You know, you just get thousands of hours of experience in that way. And you're being trained by other dermatologists in the field. So it's a very well-rounded, education. Whereas as a, let's just say, a general practitioner, they have to know basically a little about everything. So they have a very broad knowledge base, but they might not know a lot about skin because they only had a few hours in medical school or in their training about all the nuances of skin diseases. Whereas as a dermatologist, that's all we did for 4 years is learn about the skin. So I always like to say, I know a lot about a very little subject. But in that field, if you have a skin concern, a dermatologist, especially a medical doctor or a doctor of osteopathy, so an MD or a DO, is what you're looking for. Make sure that they have a board certification with the American Board of Dermatology. That's really important because there's a lot of people who will call themselves a dermatologist or a skin doctor and they are not board certified. So make sure you're looking up your doctor, making sure they're board certified, part of the American Academy of Dermatology, and that's the person you want to be seeing.
Well, thank you so much. Good advice. Could you tell us in the minute or two we have left how people could get in touch with you and where you're located, Dr. Molly?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are located in Bozeman, in the corner of College and 19th. So we're 1905 West College Street. The building is called Skincare Montana, and we are actually an affiliate of Forefront Dermatology. And we are happy to see new patients. And we're a very busy clinic. We have many doctors. We have some physician's assistants as well. You can look us up online, Skincare Montana. Our phone number is 406-587-4432. We are happy to see anybody who needs us in the community.
We want to thank you so much for this great presentation. And I thank everybody out there who has listened and who will listen on Monday evenings at 7 or 9 o'clock on Thursday mornings will be much healthier and happier. Thank you, Dr. Molly, and thank you, KGVM Gallatin Valley Group, for listening. We'll see you later.